Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Why do states use third parties to intervene in other nations' wars and conflicts? Contributing host Doug Becker interviews Andrew Mumford on the legality, efficacy, and implications of waging proxy warfare.
Conflicts are increasingly complex, and often external nations choose to intervene. But this intervention is often indirect in the form of proxy actors. On today's show, I discuss the phenomena of proxy warfare with Andrew Mumford. He's the deputy head of the School of Politics and International Relations at the University of Nottingham and the author of Proxy Warfare. Professor Mumford, first, what do we mean by proxy warfare?
I think it's important that we start to understand proxy warfare in a modern context, one that tries to evolve proxy wars away from its traditional connotations as a Cold War era style of conflict, where essentially, I think, a third party intervenes in a pre-existing war, be it a civil war, a conventional war, an insurgency-type conflict, and intervenes deliberately to try and manipulate the outcome of that conflict by arming or funding a particular party. And this is something that we've seen throughout history. And it's this sort of arms, what I'd call arm's length interference in a pre-existing conflict, which really can manipulate and change the outcome in often quite dangerous ways of pre-existing wars.
It seems to me one of the core questions here now becomes one of agency or who's driving the conflict, because there seems to be two very specific types of conflicts. The first, where local actors are fighting for political control, and it might be ideological or it might be driven by some sort of political crisis, but the external actor decides they want to choose which one of these two they would like to win. So they're enabling potentially militarized actors to fight in a war that they want in the first place, versus the notion that external actors are intervening and actually causing the war. Which is more common, and is that a fair distinction?
We've seen across the centuries that proxy wars have been visible. We've seen both kinds that you've just identified there. I think the more prevalent one is the pre-existing conflict, but one where we've seen, and this is why I've already mentioned the Cold War, because superpower politics has been integral to the way in which the amplification, the proliferation of indirect interference came about in the second half of the 20th century, because the way in which interest really got manifest in the way in which the US and the USSR went about trying to maximize their way in which their preferred partners across what we would then call the Third World manifested. I think it's actually quite important to understand the way in which that those local actors, be it communist insurgents in Angola or be it anti-communists in Vietnam, right? This is exactly the seeds that were grown for often what came to be bigger conflicts. You take Vietnam. It's often forgotten that the Vietnam War really began essentially as Dwight Eisenhower and then John F. Kennedy's proxy war, whereby they sent military advisors in, first in their dozens, then in their hundreds, then in their thousands, to try and ensure that the outcome of the Vietnamese civil conflict was manipulated towards the end game that they wanted. And these things then often grow out of control, and I'm sure we'll come on later on to talk a little bit about escalation and blowback, because this is one of the key problems when proxy wars rely on an agent and benefactor relationship. Often the benefactor, who will be throwing large amounts of money, large numbers of weapons at a partner on the ground, they can't often then dictate what gets done with that once the money, once the weapons have been delivered. So this is one of the ways in which proxy wars are actually really quite dangerous things once you let the genie out of the bottle.
You've highlighted one of those huge concerns, is that if you've got a benefactor and the benefactor is providing money or weapons to an actor, how much control does that really give them? And sort of connected to that, how much is the benefactor responsible for the actions of the proxy?
Legally, not particularly responsible whatsoever. This is why this is all boils down to a willingness on behalf of the benefactor on a case-by-case basis of how willing they are to own the problem. And this is why, actually, we are seeing a significant amount of negative consequence emerge from the proxy wars of the Cold War era. And I always return to the case of the American proxy war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, when you think about the way in which President Carter and then President Reagan really ramped up the external support for the Afghan Mujahideen, who at the time were, the logic went that they were the perfect sort of conservative anti-communist bulwark against Soviet expansionism in that part of Asia. And you're channeling huge amounts of money, huge amounts of sophisticated cutting-edge surface-to-air missile weaponry. And the moment the Soviets left, they walked away. And hastily, President George H.W. Bush had to initiate a buyback program because he realized, the Americans realized that this, the weaponry was getting out of control, and it was actually being used in jihadist organizations much further afield than Afghanistan. So the responsibility actually is a sort of a second order effect, because proxy wars rely on a very short term strategic imperative of wanting to get something done quickly, and almost long term consequence be damned. And this is why they are very problematic. They have a very, very contested legacy. Yet policymakers still to this day find it very difficult to resist the allure of an immediate potential interference and outcome change in their favor. And that's something that's hugely problematic and always has been.
And I know one of the potential motivations for the use of proxy warfare is this notion of plausible deniability, that when the United States was supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, in particular in the early stages of that intervention, they went to great lengths to try to hide the American fingerprints on those weapons. And, and so how important is the political, if not legal, plausible deniability that if these weapons are used either for actions that we would describe as war crimes, or questionable use of the weapons tactically, or like in the case of Afghanistan, by actors whose ideology is problematic?
The plausible deniability issue is intrinsically linked to perceptions of risk. And I think this is exactly why proxy war has appealed to so many nations over so many centuries, because it's a hard political calculation to decide when and how to intervene, whether you are willing to take the political risk to expend blood and treasure in using your own military forces to put boots on the ground in a foreign country to undertake an outright intervention in a pre-existing conflict, whether you are by yourself or whether you're in a much bigger formal alliance. When that perception of risk is acute, when you want to intervene, but the possibility of escalation, the international outcry that could result from you openly interfering is met with a reluctance or at least an acknowledgement that your national interest would be furthered by an intervention, but it would be harmed if it was done overtly, then this is where proxy wars have historically filled that gap, that you reduce your risk because you're not sending your own troops, but you can still get the outcome you want. And this is why Dwight Eisenhower famously called such types of indirect intervention, he called them the cheapest insurance in the world. Mm-hmm. Because if you needed it to be paid off, it could do that. And it would cost you, all it would cost you would be the hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dollars in funding, and the same again in weapons. But not a single American casualty would be taken, and you could insulate your administration from international outcry because it wasn't you doing the direct interfering. And this is part of the allure, but it's also part of the danger, and that really is the compelling problem at the heart of this particular type of conflict.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing proxy warfare with Andrew Mumford. Now, I know historically, in particular by the 1980s, the U.S. use of proxy warfare, and I'm thinking specifically in the war in Nicaragua, did create quite a bit of political blowback, both in the U.S. and internationally. The accusations that the U.S. was much more directly involved in the attacks from the Contras in Nicaragua, a famous case brought against the U.S. at the International Court of Justice. Is that a sea change, or was that just sort of idiosyncratic to that specific case where the political blowback was seemingly greater than it was in, say, previous conflicts?
I think it was idiosyncratic. I think what we started to see by that point was a greater international set of consequences. And I think in part that is due to the rise of greater media scrutiny, greater media presence in war zones, whereby you simply couldn't hide involvement anymore. And this in part is because the notion of plausible deniability works much better in theory than it does in practice. Mm-hmm. Because when the weapons that you have provided are identifiable through serial numbers or manufacturing traits, of course it will be traced back to you. So countries have to get smarter and smarter at buying indirectly, using third parties themselves in order to provide weapons and funding. So it became more difficult to keep your hands clean. And this is why the 1980s, I think, is a really important juncture in the modern history of proxy wars, because of Nicaragua, because of Afghanistan. But it's only got worse since then. But I think it did mark a turning point.
Yeah, because I think then the war that we usually, when we think of proxy warfare in the immediate post-Cold War era, is the war in the former Yugoslavia, with the support of, in particular, Bosnia and Serb proxies in Bosnia and the support that they were receiving from the government in Belgrade. First of all, the blowback against the government in Belgrade, eventually elevating to the point of a NATO airstrikes against that government, but also how that potentially complicated peace negotiations. So is that war consistent with the Cold War era? So one of the lessons is, once the Cold War ends, the use of proxy war really doesn't change all that much, or were there some significant changes?
Now, what the Yugoslav case really emphasizes is what I think is one of the most dangerous side effects and consequences of proxy wars, and that's the issue of dependence. Mm-hmm. What proxy wars do, particularly if a benefactor has spent many years forging networks, forging links, and creating the actual funding and fighting mechanisms to keep that proxy group going. Once a war is over and peace negotiations are taking place, that dependence can become even more chronic in the post-conflict period, because that proxy group can often does not have the political power to stand up on its own two feet. And this often means that what starts out as a short-term intervention could actually lead to long-term embeddedness in the body politic of another state, because the proxy has become dependent upon the benefactor. So this is why, again, the allure, or the perceived allure of a short-term intervention that from the outside looks like can be done quite cleanly. Plausible deniability, it's not our troops, there won't be any flag-draped coffins coming out the back of transporter planes with all the cameras there. No, none of that. However, The consequences are often more subtle, but they are often longer term. And this is often, the Yugoslav case is a key example of that, of actually how long-term dependence can be fostered from what begins as a very, as it were, a perceivably short-term intervention.
It does seem, though, that dependence can flow both directions, that the recipient of the weaponry, the recipient of the support, can continue to drive the conflict, in part because the external actor who's providing the support can find it politically difficult to walk away from that. I'm thinking of, for example, in Kashmir, where you have, or in particular, Pakistani support for groups within Kashmir. And it's not necessarily in Pakistan's interest to escalate that conflict, but the local actors are the ones who are conducting the attacks, and it's just difficult for the Pakistani government to walk away from that.
Yeah, that's a good example. Another really good example is the case of Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. It spent most of the 1980s being propped up by Syria, propped up by Iran. And as Hezbollah's power grew, as it became a state within a state in Lebanon, it became almost semi-autonomous. And its power, its political power grew. Its paramilitary power grew. And Hezbollah is really an interesting example of how and when a proxy can almost outgrow its relationship with its original benefactors, and almost to a point at which the Iranians, the Syrians, were still actually wanting Hezbollah to do things, and Hezbollah was able to sort of turn around and say, no, no, right, this is our agenda now. We can start calling the shots. And that's, again, proxy wars are fluid. Mm. The dynamic, the relationship can change. What the type of relationship or the level of dependency at the beginning of an intervention is absolutely not guaranteed to be the same by the end. So again, really, buyer beware with these things, because they can be dangerous. The levels of blowback are very high. The dependency shifts. The levels of escalation can change as well. So it really is quite a volatile type of conflict to get yourself involved in.
And then the issue of Yemen and Iran's role, in particular the use of the Houthis as a proxy actor. Then after the Houthis attacked the Saudi oil refinery, how much has that complicated Iran's role in Yemen and demonstrated the difficulties of the use of proxies?
Yemen is a real hotbed of proxy intervention, and that entire state, the sorry state of Yemeni politics, is in large part because it's being on the receiving end of so much external interference and third-party intervention.
Mm. I know in contemporary debates, contemporary discourses, this is really about this argument on peace proposals to get foreign fighters out of the conflict. First of all, how difficult is it to get foreign fighters out of the conflict once they're in? And secondly, will this continue to be really a popular policy, as it certainly seems to have been over the course of the last few decades?
The fight against ISIS, Daesh, in Syria and Iraq crystallizes this problem, because on one level, the global coalition, the American-led coalition, has had a dual approach. On one half, the coalition tentatively, kinetically engaged with ISIS through airstrikes. But the other strand, the war against ISIS, has in large part been an indirect one, which has relied incredibly on a proxy war strategy of arming and funding an absolute alphabet soup of different militia organizations, especially in Syria. You might circumvent the risk. You might circumvent the political problem of having large numbers of Western troops doing regime-changing wars in Middle Eastern countries. Proxy wars are there to fill that gap, to fill that strategic hole where they think, well, we don't want to cede interest. But the problem is, again and again, escalation, elongation of conflict is something that I've not mentioned and is important as well, because you often just provide enough arms to a warring party just about to keep a stalemate, just keep the war going. And that just costs more lives, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And this is why the conflict against ISIS in Syria is another is the latest chapter in the modern history of proxy wars, and the long-term blowback is yet to really be felt.
So the lesson here is that proxy wars continue to be popular, continue to be prevalent, and continue to complicate conflicts throughout the world. Thank you very much, Andrew Mumford.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Mumford is the deputy head of the School of Politics and International Relations at the University of Nottingham and the author of Proxy Warfare.